Welcome to New Books in World Affairs, and this is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with William C. Woolforth about his new book, America Abroad, The United States' Global Role in the 21st Century, which is put out by Oxford University Press and is co-written with Stephen G. Brooks. William, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you.
And before we begin, I was wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm a professor of government here at Dartmouth College, and I've been here for over 15 years teaching and doing research in international relations. Before coming here, I taught at Georgetown, and before that at Princeton. Got my PhD at Yale University, and I've had a career that bridges scholarship and teaching, and also some policy work with interaction with various foreign policy research institutes.
That's interesting. I did my undergrad at Yale University. I graduated in 99. Was there any overlap?
Nope.
Well before that?
I got my doctorate 10 years before you got your BA in the late 80s, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. As far as for our listeners, I was wondering if you could give a little more detail on why you wrote the book with Stephen.
We took on this book because we just think that a lot of people in the public at large and the foreign policy establishment commentariat, if you will, have just we're starting to just understand the United States' role in the world wrong. In particular, the book answers two basic questions. One is the United States capable of continuing to be and perform this role as the world's only superpower? I mean, does it have the basic wellsprings? Does it have the capacity to continue to act the way it has in international politics, that is to say, very actively, going forward? And the second big question was whether, if it has this capacity, and we think it does, whether it should continue to pursue this relatively actively engaged grand strategy that it's really been pursuing since the end of the Second World War. On both of those questions, the elite conversation, but also the public conversation, was moving in the opposite direction. Polls are showing that many Americans were seeing China as the number one country in the world. Polls were showing Americans also increasingly disenchanted with the United States' global role and with its sort of forward-leaning foreign policy, and that public mood was being reflected in kind of elite analytical category as well. And then in the although this began to develop after we were finishing up the book. In politics and in this election campaign, you've seen strong evidence at both the elite and popular level of people sort of going the United States' global role in completely opposite to where we see it. And so we decided to write this book to sort of see where the best scholarship comes down on these two questions.
Yeah, you're right about the rhetoric. I even notice it with the students that I teach here at our university, Ferris State University in Western Michigan. There's a lot of talk about how China's taking over the world and the U.S. needs to back up and basically let the world figure out for itself how it's going to defend itself and get back to giving Americans jobs and things like this. So I think you've hit the nail right on the head with the larger discourse. And just for our listeners, I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more about what grand strategy, what you mean by that term, and what you've seen as the consistent U.S. grand strategy, even in diverse administrations from Nixon to Carter to Reagan to Clinton to Bush.
Yeah, there's been a lot of twists and turns, and but there's been a constant core going all the way forward since really the very, very origins of the Cold War in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And that basic core is this idea that the United States best serves its own interests, as well as incidentally the interests of many other parts of the world, by actively being forward engaged and supporting security alliances around the world in support of three big objectives that have remained more or less constant. One is to basically manage security affairs in key regions so that the insecurity of those regions don't come blowing back and hitting us here in the United States. The second is to sort of be a leader in organizing cooperation to handle issues through international institutions that we can't deal with on our own. A lot of big issues that we care about just can't be handled by the United States alone. At first, this was just the global economy, but later it became other issues like environment and global warming. And the third issue is just to, inconsistent with that second one, the third big aim is to use this leadership role to work to keep the global economy humming so we don't have another sort of episode like the 1930s, which again showed how global economic downturns and recessions can blow back and hurt the United States, both in its economic interests and its security interests. So the whole idea is that the world just works better in general and for the United States if we are relatively forward engaged in key regions, the most important of those regions really being Europe and East Asia. So that, if you look at all the twists and turns, the debates, should we do that, should we do that, should we intervene here, should we intervene there, that has been a kind of a constant course since around 1949-1950.
Yeah, it's very interesting way you pose it at the beginning of the book. And another thing I like about the beginning, and I like about this book in general, is that it deals with a lot of the debates about what power is and how power is used and how people look at the issue of power. And one of the points that you nail, or both you nail at the beginning of the book, is this idea that power is more, it's just as much about preventing, for lack of a better word, unfortunate outcomes or preventing worse things. Power isn't just about, you know, compelling people to do things, but it's preventing scenarios that work against your interests. And before we get going, I was wondering if you could say more about that idea that power isn't just basically getting people to do what you want, but preventing worse outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Anytime you do anything, if you're trying to pursue some strategy in your life or in your business or in as a country, in a way, you're intervening in the world to try to make it more the way you want. And that can also be intervening, doing something to prevent it from becoming worse. One way you can think about our book is it's kind of an answer to the question that at least in part was raised by Donald Trump's presidential campaign, actually more strongly in the primary campaign, which is what would in fact happen if the United States stopped doing a lot of this stuff? What would happen if we just said we weren't going to anymore be interested in defending our NATO allies, or we insisted that they pay a high price for it? We just came home and basically said, unless you can prove to me that in dollar terms we're making money on this relationship, we're just going to cut back. And the big question is sort of what would happen if we did that, if we really pulled back, we stopped messing around with all of these problems. And our book, in a way, is trying to probe the best scholarship to answer that question. And the answer that we come at, and really having killed ourselves over years to try to get this answer, is that it really, really would be a lot worse. It would be poorer. It would be more insecure. It would be absent the kind of cooperation we need to deal with crucial problems that affect Americans of all walks of life. So the bottom line is you run that counterfactual of a U.S. that's pulling back, and the world just gets more dangerous for the United States, gets poorer, and is facing a deficit in the kinds of solutions that we need to handle global problems. So all that happens. So in a sense, if you want to ask how powerful the United States is, the best way of measuring that is to ask, what's the difference between the world today when the United States is exercising its power and the way the world would be if the United States didn't? And that difference is huge, as best as we can figure it out, which means that those who say the United States is somehow powerless, somehow it's incapable of altering things or getting what it wants, are really, really missing a huge part of the story. They're seeing the tip of the iceberg. They're missing the 90% that's underneath the surface that's actually working in favor of Americans' interests.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, and it is an assumption of a lot of the retrenchment arguments that things would somehow be better, and there's not – I mean, you can certainly debate the merits of it. You can read in all these leading journals, Foreign Affairs to others, the arguments that are made, but there is a lot of – I don't know what to call it other than maybe seeing the glass half full type of analysis with not a lot of empirical evidence. But what you've just said raises the issue of what – I mean, at the beginning of your book, you talk about the United States' position in the world and really take on the argument that the United States is a declining power. And I was wondering if you'd say a little bit more about that.
Well, it's a slightly revised version of what you just said, in that we definitely, decisively, thoroughly, and I hope entertainingly, but who knows, And we take on the issue of whether the United States can continue to be a global superpower. Is, in particular, the rise of China, but also such things as the increasingly assertive and militarily capable Russia. Are these more assertive powers and more capable powers just rendering it impossible, or it's just prohibitively expensive for the United States to continue to do this grand strategy, to continue to be a power that controls or commands the global commons, that is capable of sustaining and nurturing these alliances all around the world? And our answer to that question is no. That the change of these, the change, the rise of China, and the other changes that we see in the international system are important. They're serious. They're real. We have to look at them. They do cause us to concentrate, and it should cause us to rethink certain policies. But they don't add up to the end of the United States' 75-year-old career as the world's as a global superpower. But the reason I said there's a little nuance to your question is that does not mean that nothing has changed, or that we're still in the same world we were in the 1990s, that we should still think of the United States as being able to intervene with impunity almost anywhere. There's no question that we're in a more competitive global environment. There's no question that China, its increased military and economic capabilities are creating new challenges for the United States and its allies in East Asia. There's no doubt that Russia is just not that supine sort of chaotic power that it was in the 1990s. And love or hate Vladimir Putin, the state of Russia is just more capable than it was in the 1990s. And for those reasons, we have to focus on these things. We have to concentrate on the essence of our strategy. We have to stop frittering away resources on non-essential tasks. But none of those changes I mentioned mean that there's another global superpower out there that's going to take the United States' role, or even that Russia, China et al. Are strong enough to prevent the United States from continuing to perform this kind of role that's been playing all these years.
Yeah, I was very interested in your analysis of the problems of using the term unipolar world, and how it's kind of it's not a very precise instrument to look at changes in the international environment. Like, you compare the 1995 people were saying was a unipolar world, excuse me, to today. That term is still, people, scholars have tried to come around with something, but it's not a very good way to look at the changes and give the United States grounding in its strategy to use the term unipolar. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that.
Yes, it's a very popular term, and I have to, in full disclosure, say that I used the term and developed arguments about unipolarity that I still think are right, that I developed in the 1990s. But over time, it became clear to me and my co-author and colleague Steve Brooks that the term was kind of getting in the way of a debate over how much the world is changing. Because basically the problem with unipolarity, it's one of these categories, it's either you are or you aren't. It's dichotomous. Either it's unipolar or it's not. And you have this big debate going, is the world still unipolar, or is it completely, totally different? And so that leads to kind of a polarized argument between everything is people who claim, look, everything is changing. We're basically back in the world the way it was. The United States is just no longer capable of being a superpower, versus those who say, no, nothing has changed. We're in the exact same situation. It's still unipolar. And that just misses the kinds of changes that I was just referring to a second ago. We clearly are not in the 1990s anymore. There's no question about the fact that China is capable of presenting challenges for U.S. strategy in that region that are totally different than the 1990s. And the same goes for Russia and other countries. Power has diffused. Capabilities have diffused in comparison to the 1990s. But the United States status as the only superpower is in fact unchanged. So we got change, but we also have continuity. And the polarity concept, especially this term unipolar, just is not very good at capturing that aspect of it.
Yeah, I think it's a very important section of your book to read for anyone interested in history and looking at the international environment. And another effective part of this book is the way that you raise fundamental questions about the Chinese position in the world, whether it's, it's to some degree the limitations of its economic power and military power. But you devote a lot of attention to why China may not be as powerful as some people think, as it tries to make that transition to a superpower. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about China's place in the world today.
Yeah, I'd say that any listeners to this podcast who are really interested in this debate about the rise of China, would, I think, get some intellectual profit out of reading from reading those chapters of our book, where we do dive into pretty deep detail and get into deep in the numbers and the best available data and trying to track where China is now vis-a-vis the United States and where it's going, how long it might take for the United States to close the gap or to become a state that would be properly compared to the United States on the global stage as a superpower. But I think we can summarize all of that data and all of that analysis by the conclusion that basically what it does is all this analysis and data is they invalidate an easy, facile comparison between the rise of China vis-a-vis the United States today and the rise of past challenging states in previous eras. So people like to look at China and think, well, that's just like the rise of the United States itself when Britain was the top dog, or it's just like the rise of Germany vis-a-vis Britain, or it's just like the rise of the Soviet Union vis-a-vis the United States. But there's a couple of really, really huge differences with the rise of China. And just two, I think, of the most important differences are, number one, China still is, compared to those past rising states, China, despite its huge accomplishments, China remains technologically much further behind the United States than those other rising powers were behind the leading states of their day. I mean, Germany was in many ways ahead technologically of Great Britain when it was rising. Yeah. The Soviet Union, people like to poo-poo it today, but back in the 1950s and 60s, it was matching or even exceeding the United States on some key technological and militarily relevant technological dimensions. China is much, much farther behind the United States today than those states were in their day. But the second thing is even more important. The second thing that distinguishes China's rise from these other analogies people like to refer to, and that is that it's just harder to compete today than it was in those days. The technology, the organizational acumen that you need to act as a superpower is just intrinsically harder. In some sense, the bar has been raised for creating the kind of capabilities the United States has compared to the way it used to be in the middle of the 20th century. And if you put those two things together, China's relatively underdeveloped technological status and the higher bar for achieving superpower status, you come to the conclusion that as impressive as China's rise is and as important as the changes its rise have wrought are, it is not now nor soon going to be in a position to sort of create the kind of capabilities that would either match those the United States has and uses to be a superpower or that would negate the U.S.'s capability to continue to act as a superpower. So these are really big tectonic shifts that I don't think many people in the sort of foreign policy commentariat world have properly appreciated.
Yeah, it's a very important argument, and I would encourage all the listeners to really digest that part of the book. I would tell them to read your article in Foreign Affairs, but I'll actually encourage them more to get more detail about it, to go out and get your book, because it's developed in more detail and really done effectively. It was a joy to read. And another part of that that argument that really stood out to me as a reader, as an informed, interested reader, was how you raise issues about measuring the size and strength of the Chinese economy by raising issues about using GDP as a measure of economic power. And that, I thought, was a really interesting section. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about how to measure the strength of economies in this increasingly globalized age.
Yeah, I guess my response would be sort of read the Foreign Affairs article. If you don't believe it, read the book, or if you're really interested in it, read the book. Because the Foreign Affairs article that we wrote does try to capture some of these arguments, but there's absolutely no way in that context you can really get into it. And what we do when we look at this key fixation that people have with a gross domestic product, the measure of output of an economy, is we really try to probe the recent most exciting research from economics on that, the use of that indicator. And we also try to look hard at China experts. So there's people who are experts on the China economy who have the capacity to reach Chinese sources to really monitor that economy closely. And it really does emerge from this kind of literature that gross domestic product is important. It captures important things, but it's missing an awful lot. And it's particularly problematic when used to compare economies at very different levels of their development cycle, namely an emerging middle-income country like China with a particular kind of political economy focused on a particular model, and a highly advanced wealthy country like the United States. We can get into the details, but the GDP number just doesn't capture a lot of crucial things. Just to name one example, you know, a lot of China's growth, just as U.S. growth, by the way, was 100 years ago, a lot of it is developed, generated by really severe depletion of the environment. Now, the problem is that's counted as GDP. I mean, if you take chemicals and you pour them into a field, all that output, all of that environmental destruction is not counted as part of GDP. And then once you try to clean up that chemical dump, that's also part of GDP. Now, of course, both the United States and China do things that are hurting their environment. It's just that the degree to which GDP is missing this is far greater for China right now because of the nature of its development model than it is for the United States. We could replicate that across the board in different categories and show how GDP is missing the real size of the economy. The bunch of economists have really worked hard trying to measure really the wealth of an economy. The problem with GDP is it's a flow, so it's an annual flow, and it's sort of like your income. It's measuring kind of what you earn each year without measuring how much you actually have in assets. So I could look at my neighbor, might be earning a lot more than me, but what if I have five times more actual assets invested? And this new measure of so-called inclusive wealth tries to capture that aspect. Mm-hmm. And by that measure, the United States dramatically, by many multiples, dominates China. Let me say just one final thing on this whole comparison issue. And I say it with some reservation, but I can't resist noting it. And that is that, you know, I kind of cut my teeth as an international relations scholar back at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was seen as in a very, very powerful state. And there were sort of gross aggregate indicators. People then usually looked at military spending that they sort of used to sort of simplify the problem of measuring Soviet power. And clearly those measures were missing the kind of weak underpinnings of the gross output that the Soviet economy was attaining. And I wouldn't say that the analysis of China now is exactly analogous to the analysis of the late Soviet Union, but there's certainly a cautionary tale there for just looking at gross output numbers and not looking, sort of lifting up the rug and looking under beneath and seeing what's going on. And when you do that, it tends to attenuate the impression created by just citing GDP statistics.
Yeah, I may be getting the details a little wrong, but didn't Galbraith, the economist, write some book in the mid-80s that the Soviet Union's economy, based on its numbers, was functioning quite well and would endure into the future? He wrote something like that in a book, and it kind of missed the basic problems of the command economy.
Yeah, there were a lot of books like that and claims like that. The East German economy in the 1990s, according to official statistics, was measuring as being wealthy, beating out middle-income European countries and beginning to approach Great Britain. The problem was that a gigantic amount of that output was waste. And essentially, you can build a bazillion incredibly bad computers. The Germans had invested gigantic sums into sort of becoming the technological leaders of the Soviet Union's Warsaw Pact, but those things were hugely inefficient and wasteful. Similarly, a gigantic chunk of the infrastructure investment that we see in China today, which is hugely impressive, by the way, for an American. I mean, you can't go to China and not say, dang, these are nice trains, these are beautiful airports, these are fabulous roads. But recent studies have shown how just a gigantic amount of that infrastructure investment is wasted. And so it's counting as GDP. It looks really impressive, but at least some of it is, and in long term, may end up being a liability on the Chinese economy.
Sure, that's a good point. And as you advance through the book, you lay out this idea that the United States, you know, should more or less follow the strategy of deep engagement. And in chapter 4, you bring up the idea, for more as I see it, is to get the readers into what deep engagement is. And what deep engagement isn't. And you use this concept of the edge of deep engagement, and you raise some of the issues that possible objections to following a deep engagement strategy. And I was wondering if you could give the listeners perhaps a little better sense of what deep engagement is as a strategy and what it isn't as a strategy.
Deep engagement, at the core of it, it's this idea that we've got some really, really important parts of the world that are really, really important for U.S. security. We care about the fate of these regions, and it would hurt us if these regions became highly destabilized. The two most important ones are East Asia and Europe. A secondary, a third and also important region is the Middle East. Of course, the United States cares about Latin America and puts a lot of effort into trying to maintain a good relationship and keep geopolitical competitors out of Latin America. We care about South Asia. We care about Africa. But the regions I mentioned are the ones where investments by the United States have particularly good payoffs in terms of our big interests. So this grand strategy, the core of the idea is that, you know, we want to make some investments to keep those regions more secure than they would be if we were to back off. So to give an example, we have a security treaty with Japan, and that, you know, entails risks and costs to the United States. If we were to pull back from that security treaty in the view of the logic of this grand strategy, the region would become far less secure. Japan would almost certainly decide it had to ramp up its military capabilities. It would probably nuclearize. China and Korea and other countries would respond. And the likelihood is East Asia would plunge into a far less secure world, which would have very, very bad reverberations for a whole range of United States interests. So here I'm describing to you in the East Asian context what we consider the core of the grand strategy. By the way, has been constant since the very early Cold War. But that, you have to ask yourself, does that core, does that essence, that key kind of strategic bet on remaining engaged in these regions, does that demand constant expansion? Do we, as part of this grand strategy, must we always expand it? So, for example, if a country comes along and says, we'd like to be an ally of yours, are we obligated to say yes under every circumstance? In our argument, in our view, those kinds of episodes raise this debate over where's the edge and where's the core. And to my mind, the question to ask if you're asked to add a new obligation to an existing strategy is, what is it bringing to the United States' interests? Is it crucial to sustain the current commitments or not? We're able to identify some examples to try to illustrate this point, that expanding the commitments, the existing roster of commitments, is not always necessary to sustain the core. So an example would be Ukraine. Ukraine would like to become a NATO ally, or at least one element of its politics would like to become a NATO ally. You can debate whether the United States should do it or not. What Steve and I can say in our book pretty conclusively is that expanding the U.S. roster of security commitments to Ukraine is not necessary to sustain the core of the grand strategy. It is an option. And we think Americans should think very, very carefully before adding potentially expensive new commitments in an era in which, as I was talking about 10 minutes ago, in an era in which the challenges from actors like China and Russia are getting more intense. So that's just one example. Another very quickly would be, does the grand strategy that we followed all of these years, does the core of it demand that we push democratization very hard? Does it demand indeed intervention, military or otherwise, in order to try to expand the roster of democratic countries? And our answer is no, it doesn't. In fact, the grand strategy has often worked with the United States dealing with very, very unsavory leaders in the pursuit of those core interests that I mentioned. So again, it's not that I'm against spreading democracy. I think democracy is great. The question is, at what cost to the core missions of the grand strategy is any given mission of expanding a democracy? And right now, I think it's quite clear that large-scale armed intervention on behalf of trying to spread the democratic ideal is just not consistent with sustaining the core of the grand strategy, nor is it a sort of advisable course. So the United States, I think, already has under Obama and should continue to de-emphasize this idea of the use of military force in pursuit of sustaining or expanding democratic governance.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, and that's – it seems to get at a lot of the potential critiques of your argument that deep engagement leads to you know, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or leads to costly interventions. And we'll see, you can certainly say more about that as we go through the interview. But I think you make a very important point when you describe how a lot of the declinist talk of the United States today is grounded in something called rising expectations about what the United States can do and should do as a nation. In other words, is the United States declining, a declining power, because it can't use its power to more or less reshape the map of the Middle East in ways that fit its interests in Afghanistan and Iraq? To make, is the U.S. declining because it didn't make Iraq a liberal democracy, or, you know, make people in Afghanistan, or at least some people, not throw acid in the face of women who go to school? I think that's an important point to ground a lot of the declinist arguments in, this idea of rising expectations.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that the there's been a fairly important gyration, or a kind of cycle of perhaps hubris or overestimation of American power, then followed by perhaps underestimation of American capabilities. So I think it's fair to say that at the turn of the millennium, as we finished up the 1990s with a decade of such seeming successes as the interventions in the Balkans, the interventions in Kosovo, the spread of expansion of NATO, the successful U.S. efforts to spread various aspects of globalization, the so-called Washington Consensus. One can go down a long list that by around 2000, people were basically starting to see the United States as this incredibly capable state. Indeed, all the talking heads were saying, oh, unipolarity is not a strong enough term. We need to, you know, the United States is really an empire, you know. And at that time, Brooks and I were watching this, saying, this is ridiculous. This is terrible. I mean, they're going overboard. They're losing it here. They're freaking some sort of.
Yeah.
And the result was indeed, I think, a period where it's fair to say that the United States leadership and elites radically overestimated their capabilities. It was that mood, that sense that you could go into complicated, vexed countries. And with the judicious application of military capability, by the way, not enough to require anything like the draft or, God forbid, a tax increase. No. With extant existing forces in being, that you could do an expeditionary war 8,000 miles away from the U.S. homeland in a troubled a state that had been under a dictatorship for generations, with deep divisions among sectarian communities. We could somehow go in there and transform it and create a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. You look back on those beliefs, and they just seem completely insane. The only thing to ask is, in a sense, is of what other country would anyone ever expect that kind of capability? The fact that it was a pipe dream, the fact that the United States could not do it and has not succeeded in doing it, does not tell you that the United States is weak. It tells you that people in the early 2000s radically overestimated U.S. capabilities.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the American leaders at the time would have benefited from reading the ancient Greeks and their warnings about hubris and military overstretch and power. I think I've done interviews with other authors who really make the argument that some people in the administration literally thought going into Iraq would be a replay of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and people would want freedom and they'd be all happy and get along. So I think you raise an important point there.
It's true that when we talk about the United States' role in the world, we talk about this grand strategy of deep engagement. We ought to be clear-eyed about the risks. There are a lot of risks, and we believe very, very seriously dangerous risks of pulling back from the world. But there are also risks involved in the strategy the United States has been followed. And one of those is, in fact, hubris. One of those is, in fact, the idea that the United States is indispensable for every single question in the world, that we ought to be leading everything, that in no region of the globe where there's a crisis can the United States safely stand aside and see if local actors can handle it. And we believe that that does require prudence, and it does require restraint. That the grand strategy does run this risk of hubris, of overcommitment, of an inflated sense of obligation to serve interests that are not central to the United States. And so we do think that we have to be cognizant of it. And I don't want to get partisan here, because I'm really actually not. I'm a I'm a registered, I'm a non-affiliated voter, but I will say that I've stood from the halls of academia here watching the debate over President Obama, and I can say that at times you can identify things that clearly seem to be mistaken, but overall this constant refrain that he hasn't led enough, he hasn't gotten out in front of issues, is hard for me to understand given how much trouble that very same sentiment has gotten this country in so very recently. So I have, even as I'm a strong supporter, and I believe the scholarship strongly backs a globally engaged role for the United States, I think that needs to be coupled with a kind of circumspection concerning new and expensive commitments that we've seen in recent years in Washington. And I think that should basically remain a lodestar of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, my dad, don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole, but he's a big Trump supporter, hates Obama. And I've heard him within the same conversation say, why doesn't Obama use the troops more to get rid of these terrorists in Iraq? And then in the same breath, he'll say, we in the United States shouldn't be fighting foreign wars for other people. he'll make that argument in the same stretch. So he doesn't like square his logic in terms of critiquing Obama. He critiques him for both not doing enough and potentially doing too much. So it's quite... it's quite an amazing argument to make, but I think you're right about the soundness of a lot of Obama's moves in that regard. But getting back to your book, it's when you develop chapters 5 and 6, you, as far as the deep engagement strategy, you look at the security benefits of deep engagement for the United States from a theoretical, and then I would call it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, an in practice type of analysis. And I was wondering if you'd say a little bit more about what the United States gets from a security perspective by engaging in a deep engagement strategy.
Well, it's essentially an attempt to the strategy is an attempt to make the world more secure for the United States and its interests. And the idea here is the big innovation, of course, it doesn't seem like an innovation because almost everybody who listens to this podcast will have been born after this innovation first came into fruition. The innovation is the idea that, well, the reason we call the strategy deep engagement, this innovation is if you are willing to offer some security guarantees to some key partners that will make the world and the particular regions you're involved in more secure in a way that will reduce long-term threats to core U.S. national security interests at the same time as they generate these various other benefits that we discussed later in the book. So when you look purely at the security commitments, the idea is simply that helping other countries with their security, making some commitments to help them defend themselves, will prevent various regions from either becoming seats of internecine conflict, as I suggested could happen between, let us say, Japan and China if the United States weren't there, or from becoming ripe targets for external powers to aggrandize themselves at the expense of the United States and ultimately constitute threats to the United States. So there the example, of course, is the containment of Soviet power in Europe after the Second World War. So both things work. In other words, you're making the security commitment to try to reduce the insecurity of people within the region so that, say, back in the 1950s, France didn't once again fall into a rivalry against Germany. And you're at the same time trying to keep that region relatively immune from external predatory moves by outside powers, in the Cold War case, the Soviet Union. And so by making them more secure, you're overall making the region more secure and therefore reducing the probability that bad things are going to come out of that region and hit the United States. And one of the most important of those bad things that come out of the region and hit the United States is this idea of nuclear proliferation. Every United States administration since Truman has essentially had an attitude of trying to limit nuclear proliferation, except to very, very close allies. Overall, wanting to have fewer states in possession of nuclear weapons than more. And the bottom line is here, after all of these years, 65, 70 years of working on this issue, way fewer states now have nuclear weapons than everybody expected. The technical capacity is there. Now, I think if you were to survey all of the scholarship, if you really had a lot of time on your hands, because believe me, it takes a lot of time, if you were to survey all of scholarship and really come to a consensus answer, what's the number one reason why more states don't have nuclear weapons? I think the number one reason almost certainly is this grand strategy that the United States has followed. By providing some states with security, it reduces their demand for nuclear weapons. This would be the example that I gave you of Japan or South Korea, Taiwan, many such countries. At the same time, that forward and gain strategy gives the United States a lot of tools to disincentivize states from obtaining nuclear weapons. That is to say, coercive tools or sanctions that it can develop through developing and building up posses of like-minded states. There is no way the U.S. could have pursued this counterproliferation strategy if it didn't have the grand strategy of deep engagement. So that's an example of where the security commitments are the fulcrum or the basis of strategies meant to intervene in the world in ways or actively engage with the world in ways to reduce long-term threats to U.S. security. We think, Steve and I, that the American foreign policy establishment is in fact right on one issue, and that is that having a lot more states with nuclear weapons, especially weak states or states that are in intense rivalries with others, is a bad thing for U.S. security interests. Not only might those things get used, but the more states that have them, the more opportunities there are for non-state actors to get their hands on nuclear weapons. So those are just a couple of examples of how we walk through the security benefits of this deep engagement grand strategy.
Yeah, it's very effectively done. And the statement that stood out to me, I come from a diplomatic historian background, just for your information, was when you wrote that realism supports deep engagement. You take on a lot of realist thought that talks about the benefits of retrenchment, and to write that realism supports deep engagement, I think is quite interesting. When you take on concepts like entrapment and soft balancing, we don't need necessarily go into the details of that, but I mean, at the end of the day, I really thought it was an interesting part of the book about how the United States has taken a lot of precautions to make sure that it doesn't get entrapped, as a lot of theory might suggest.
Yeah, and this, what was quite fascinating was to see this issue come to the fore in the Republican primary in the early part of this campaign, when Donald Trump raised this issue of entrapment, which he's worried, and I think it's a legitimate point, that we make these commitments to allies, and what if they then drag us into conflicts that really aren't directly connected to U.S. interests? What happens if we secure an ally, and then the ally says, hey, I've got Uncle Sam behind me. Why don't I now get more aggressive with my neighbor since I've got the backing of Uncle Sam? Why don't I get more aggressive with my neighbor and try to kind of, stir up some trouble here, make some gains for myself, perhaps security gains, perhaps political gains, and then suddenly, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I've made my neighbor mad, and now I'm going to call in my chit and ask Americans to come and defend me. So that's a legitimate concern. When you are providing security alliances, you better be darn sure that that entrapment issue doesn't get you down the road. But what we find, again, through a comprehensive survey of academic research, is that these entrapment fears are really not very well grounded in historical experience, for the simple reason that American leaders aren't as stupid as you think they are. I mean, basically, we can denounce them all the time, and yeah, they do stupid stuff sometimes. But here, they're very, 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 very careful to write into these treaties protections against exactly that issue. And the fact of the matter is, the reason we say realism, the school of political realism, supports this is because basically realism as a way of thinking about international relations tends to say strong states kind of get what they want usually, and weak states kind of have to deal with it. Well, the fact is, in all of these alliances, the United States is the strong state and the ally is the weak state. And basically, the United States takes careful actions to ensure that it's not dragged in. And in fact, the best evidence is for the contrary to be true. If you look at the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, look, you can poo-poo the contribution of our allies, but the fact is they did contribute a hell of a lot. And actually on a per capita basis or controlled for the size of their economy, some of them contributed more than we did. So that's a memo to Donald Trump. And they did so mainly because they were trying to make the United States happy. As a lot of these countries, Canada, Estonia, Poland, they didn't have a big stake in Afghanistan. They went in there because they're trying to prove that they're good allies to the United States. So overall, I think the entrapment issue that Trump raised and some critics of American grand strategy raised, I think that's a legit issue. It's an important issue. But we just don't find a hell of a lot of evidence that the United States has somehow dropped the ball or failed to be attentive to that issue.
Yeah, it's an important point, and it's an effective part of the book. And several of the chapters, beyond dealing with the issue of security, deal with the economic costs and benefits of having this grand strategy. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the issue that a deep engagement strategy would simply just cost too much money and ruin the American economy.
Well, there's, again, very, very little evidence for that. There's no question that a globally engaged grand strategy is going to cost somewhat more than a strategy that pulls back to the U.S. homeland. But Trump and other critics they exaggerate the degree to which the deep engagement strategy is too costly. That is to say that they exaggerate the delta or the difference between the cost of a pullback strategy and the cost of deep engagement. There is a difference, but it's not that huge because the U.S. is going to want to maintain, according to them, some pretty strong capabilities. Just want to deploy them here in the United States. And deploying stuff abroad is more expensive than at home, but not as much as more expensive as you might think, because we get various subsidies from the allies for that purpose. But they also exaggerate the degree to which military spending at the level the United States does is damaging to the economy. There's just no evidence for that. So spending at the sub 4% of GDP level, that's going to hurt your long-term economic performance. If you survey the academic research, you just can't come up with many results that substantiate that point. The consensus view is you've kind of got to ramp up to much higher levels than the United States is doing before you can really start to worry that defense spending is harming the economy writ large. And finally, all of those arguments fail to calculate in the balance sheet the economic benefits of the strategy. Now, I wouldn't oversell these benefits, but there are benefits. The United States simply gains, by virtue of maintaining this grand strategy, leverage or influence for managing global economic questions that it wouldn't have otherwise. It is partly the kind of capability that we talked about earlier, the kind of power that we talked about earlier, which is the United States has this posse of allies it can call upon if needed to try to defend its preferred positions on global economic questions. But it's also the case that if the U.S. pulled back and that led to a lot of insecurity, a lot of increased rivalry, possibly even wars, that all will be extremely bad for the global economy. And since the U.S. is the biggest player in the global economy, things that are really bad for the global economy are also bad for the United States. So if you tabulate, attempt to do as best you can, a full reckoning of the modest but real economic cost of the strategy and the modest but real economic gains of the strategy, that basically takes a lot of the air out of that whole economic critique of the strategy that is so favored of its critics.
Yeah, you also make the important point that a lot of America's economic problems are not exactly related to having a sort of a global hedge. Or not, maybe that's not the right word, but it's global preponderance of position that a lot of the problems deal with. I don't, maybe domestic's not the right term, but they have little to do with the problem of deep engagement, that they're related to other problems that similar rich countries would have. So I think that's an interesting point that readers, or excuse me, listeners would benefit from reading or listening to.
Yes, we often imagine that if we could cut defense spending, we would take the money freed up, and that the money that would be freed up from defense spending would be used for optimal purposes that whatever the reader or listener wants. So if the listeners are on the more liberal side of the spectrum, they imagine defense spending being freed up and used to support social welfare programs, to buttress things this country does to help less fortunate Americans, or be used for infrastructure. On the other side of the equation, on the right hand of the spectrum, people imagine the freed up money from defense spending being handed back to the people in terms of reduced taxes, or being used to pay down debt. There is no guarantee that either of those uses would in fact happen. We could end up squandering this money on who knows what. In other words, you can't assume a perfectly efficient polity. And a lot of the deep long-run problems. I think if you consult most economists and they ask, like, what's in the way of the U.S. kind of getting back on that rapid growth track that it used to be on back in the 1950s and 1960s, in the middle of the last century, I don't think this 50 or 60 billion a year on defense that people are talking about would be cited as the reason for that. The reasons are far more complicated. So as you say, the deep causes of the economic malaise in parts of the country, of the dissatisfaction or sense of disenfranchisement that you see in swaths of the country, I don't think that those are actually connected to the grand strategy. I think they're much more closely connected to choices made here at how we allocate our resources here at home.
Yeah, it's an important point. And when I read the book, especially the latter chapters, I had a flashback to maybe a couple years ago. A student in class near the end of the class said, you know, why do we need to participate in the United Nations? Why do we need NATO? Why do we need all these international institutions? Don't they just keep us down? Don't they, you know, why do we need to, you know, shouldn't we be more unilateral? I think he said something like that. And one of the things that comes through, at least from my reading of your book, is all the benefits and potential exercise of power that the United States exercises by engaging these international institutions, however you define them, whether it be from NATO to the IMF, that it is a form of legitimacy and power.
It is, and it also, once again, returns to our refrain here in this conversation about blocking power or power to prevent worse things from happening or power that occurs under the scene. If you look at the United Nations, for example, boy, it sure often seems like, man, that United Nations, what a bunch of pikers. They're constantly beefing about the United States. They're constantly passing resolutions that we don't like, and blah, blah, blah. And there's certain truth to that. But what you don't realize is that underneath the surface, the United States has really powerful influence throughout the UN. And in the one hand, it can help stymie that international body from doing things that would really undermine the United States and its legitimacy. But also can occasionally deploy that body in ways that are very, very useful to the United States. Just to give one example, again, under the radar, but really important, is, you know, trying to go after terrorists and terrorist financing and trying to get countries to pass legislation that makes it easier for us to track where they're getting their money and to track transporter flows of funds that go to terrorist organizations. You know, after 9/11, there was a lot of sympathy for the United States, appropriately so. And we were able to push through UN top bodies, including the Security Council, a raft of new international legal obligations that, by the way, are legally binding on all members of the UN regarding terrorist finance, regarding reporting on terrorist activities, regarding these kinds of information gathering activities that are crucial for the United States counterterror effort. No one involved in that program would disagree with the claim that if we start becoming more standoffish with respect to these international institutions, if we start bashing them too much, or indeed in the extreme case, pull out of them, our counterterror efforts would really, really suffer.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And I think it raises the issue. If you read the book, there are all sorts of benefits from deep engagement. And you can argue, I mean, like any book, you're going to raise arguments. People are going to read it and say, I don't agree with this. I mean, so it's like any book, a good book that makes you think about important issues. But I think you raise an issue that deserves some attention for our listeners, is at the end of the day, with all this scholarship and a lot of evidence calling into question the basic assumptions of retrenchment, and we kind of talked about this at the beginning, but why retrenchment seems to appeal to so many people. With all the ways that the world works in the United States' interests, even after disastrous wars, especially in Iraq, why we would want to give that up? Why do so many people, even if you present them with this body of evidence, will nonetheless gravitate toward a strict retrenchment policy?
Well, I think the biggest answers there are two words, Iraq and Afghanistan. Even though we think that certainly the democracy promotion, you know, certainly the invasion of Iraq and the hugely ambitious program that the Bush administration attempted in Iraq are not in any sense necessary for the deep engagement mission, deep engagement strategy. I think that's the frustration of those two wars, the exhaustion. I think the terrible human toll they've taken on American service members, their families, the economic costs have just basically led to a sense of fatigue, Iraq syndrome, people call it. And I think it's a terrible decision. It's one of the worst foreign policy decisions this country has ever made. And it's not surprising that it has led to a frustration with the overall strategy. I actually think if you probe deeper into American views and American opinions, you'll find that the support for pulling back is less than it seems. Because often it's easy for a respond to a poll, say, yeah, I'm frustrated, I think we should do this or that. But the core of the strategy of retrenchment, the core of it, is to get rid of allies. The core of it is to basically say, allies, you're on your own. Europe, you're on your own. We don't want NATO. We don't want the Japan alliance. We don't want to be allied to South Korea anymore. We're ditching these alliances. We're going to go it alone. We're going to go America first in Donald Trump's argument. And basically, I think if you start asking most Americans, do you prefer a world in which we don't have allies? I think most of them don't like that. I think most of them want to have allies. I think they don't want America to be alone. And they value these connections. And so I think that partly it's the fact is that the strategy we have is this is the devil we know. We know it and we are easy to complain and beef about it. Whereas this other grand strategy is the one we don't know. And it can sometimes seem wonderful and beautiful. But I think the more they really examine that alternative strategy and think about what it would mean for them, I think that they'll all of a sudden see the virtues of what we're doing.
Yeah, you make an effective case that deep engagement is really a necessary approach to deal effectively with things like terrorism. The problem of nuclear proliferation would get worse, and that would certainly be bad. You have good sections about, you take on some of the assumptions of retrenchment and by extension realist theorists who either don't pay attention to economic issues that much or tend to emphasize the way that markets will correct themselves pretty easily. I mean, at the end of the day, in this globalized world, you know, would a war in Asia not affect the United States? I mean, not affect the United States that much? That seems like a questionable assumption. I mean, I guess when I read this book, did you know about a lot of these arguments, or did it surprise you the way that some the scholarship that you read seemed to discount these seemingly major events or possibilities?
Well, I've been aware of this. I mean, this argument about retrenchment or pulling back has long been popular in certain academic circles. And indeed, I think it's fair to say some sort of strategy broadly belonging to that category of restraint, pulling back, retrenchment, whatever you want, offshore balancing, whatever you want to call it, was for at least a time, and maybe still is, the most popular strategy among a contingent of experts that we would call security scholars or international scholars of international security. And so I've been grappling with these arguments for really decades, and the argument really picked up after the end of the Cold War. The argument really began to gain strength. It's like, why are we still involved in the world? We created this grand strategy of deep engagement to deal with the Soviet Union. Soviet Union's gone. Why don't we come home? So these arguments have been out there, including the ones about the possibility the United States would not suffer terribly much from increased insecurity abroad and wouldn't suffer economically. So, for example, one of the best articles written on that by two wonderful scholars named Eugene Goltz and Darrell Press, I should say, is my colleague here at Dartmouth, was arguing that, you know, a war in Asia would be no problem. That article was written in 2001. So this scholarship has been out there for a while. What has changed in recent years is how much those views have begun to enter the policy mainstream and enter the public consciousness. It's always been a popular strategy among academics, security scholars. It's now becoming a policy that occasionally seems an attractive thing to people outside of that world.
Yeah, I think you're right, and it seems to make sense to a lot of people. It's not an exact analogy, but when I read this book, I remembered right when I was coming out of my undergraduate days, was around the time I grew up in Minnesota, when the Minnesota elected Jesse Ventura.
Yeah.
And the arguments that my dad voted for him and others, and they kept saying that we need change. It doesn't necessarily – and I'd be like, well, what does change mean with Jesse Ventura? And they were like, well, I don't know, but it's got to be better than what's going on now with these idiots in the White House – or not the White House, but the Minnesota State Capitol. And it began to come more mainstream, and he eventually got elected. But it took about – not – well, I don't want to have a strict time frame, but it didn't take very long before people were like, what the hell have we done? He left a very unpopular governor and did a lot of things that angered people. And I don't think it's an exact analogy to maybe what you're doing in your book, but it seems to me that a lot of people, there is a lot of explanatory power in this idea that retrenchment is not the status quo. Something's got to be better than the status quo. Let's give it a try. I think you're on to something there when you advance that argument.
I totally agree. It's a thing we grapple with throughout the book. It's the status, I mean, the strategy, although we think it's been overdone, we think there's been mistakes, we think some presidents have taken this thing way too far, but the core of the strategy is the status quo, and the status quo is upsetting to people. I mean, we see lots of bad stuff happening. ISIS and attacks and god-awful attacks in Europe, refugee flows, Syria falling apart. In one way, it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. You intervene in Libya, yeah. It goes south. You don't intervene in Syria, it goes south. And that's why often referring back to your conversation with your father, the critics of Obama often seem unfair. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. It's so damn frustrating. It's nice to think of some really radical policy change. And that's you know, at a rhetorical front, that's what you confront in this kind of debate. And our book, in a sense, is really trying to be very, very serious about asking the question, what would the counterfactual look like? What would the world look like if we followed a different strategy? You need to think long and hard about that. We've tried to simplify the task for readers in this book by doing all the grunt work of asking what does scholarship, you know, what do theories, models, evidence, what does the best scientific thinking tell us that counterfactual world will look like? And the bottom line is the counterfactual world would be a lot worse for the United States if we didn't do this stuff. But they can't expect that necessarily to resonate with everybody who's just occasionally glancing at the newspaper, watching the news, and seeing lots of bad stuff.
Yes, I agree. And William, I can't thank you enough. I've taken a lot of your time and asked you a lot of questions. I really appreciate your speaking with me. But I'm going to have to pick your brain at least one last time here. And perhaps it's an unfair question, but it seems to me that if you could put on the policy cap for a second and just, if you're speaking to, say, Trump if he gets elected or Hillary Clinton if she gets elected, and you get like 1 minute in front of the president or something, like maybe five, I don't know, and you could distill what you think are the most important things for him or her to take from your book and take about deep engagement, what would you tell them?
I think it would be to look hard and examine the fundamental core of American grand strategy that has worked so well for 70 years, making this country and indeed large swaths of the world more secure and prosperous than ever. Look at that core, ask yourself what it is. And when you undertake any foreign policy obligation beyond that core, ask yourself, do I risk the core of this grand strategy by undertaking this new obligation? Am I doing anything that is putting at risk the basic principles that have served the United States so well for so long? Examine each new obligation with that core in your mind, and you can't go too far wrong in foreign policy of the United States.
Excellent. Very good. And one more question, and then I'll let you go. I was wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit more your future plans and research and or teaching.
I have a lot of things underway. I want to just focus on one project I'm working on with a wonderful scholar from the London School of Economics, Vladislav Zubok, who I've known since the Cold War. We're working on a project where we're trying to understand what happened with Russia. So I also have one of my hats as I do analyze Russian foreign policy. What happened with Russia? We're trying to ask this question. To what degree is the more pugnacious Russian policy, in some sense, the fault of the West or the United States by somehow failing to integrate Russia into some sort of larger community of nations? Did we blow it? Did we alienate them? Or is Russia's current course in international politics largely the result of developments internal to Russia? This is one of the biggest debates right in American foreign policy circles, and we're going to try to do an evidence-based, research-based answer to that question.
That sounds like a very needed and quite relevant project. I can't tell you enough how interested I would be in reading such a book.
Well, we hope there's a few more like you.
Yeah, my specialty in U.S. foreign policy is U.S. foreign policy, and I've written my publications on U.S. Russian Soviet relations. Ah. So anyways, once again, William, thank you for speaking with me. I can't endorse this book enough to our listeners. Beyond being a book that makes complex theory from the social sciences accessible to general readers, it lays out a lot of arguments I think it was very easy to follow. It's a book that I think general readers can get. I think it would work well in certainly upper level classes for undergrads. If I were teaching a graduate seminar in U.S. foreign policy, this would definitely be one of the books I would use. So on that note, I think it's a fantastic book that deserves a wide readership.
Well, thank you very much for both the interview and those kind words about the book.